Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I'm talking to Philip Roscoe from St. Andrews University about his new book, A Richer Life, How Economics Can Change the Way We Think and Feel, which is published by Penguin in 2015. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Philip Roscoe from St. Andrews University about his book, A Richer Life, How Economics Can Change the Way We Think and Feel. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great to have you on, actually, and this is a really fascinating book that contributes to a growing, I guess, kind of disquiet about economics, and it does it in a variety of ways, which we're going to talk through. I wonder if we could kick off with you giving some background about your own career and the way the book came about, and particularly, actually, I'm interested in the book as a kind of mass market popular paperback full of interesting academic ideas.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you read it like that. That's exactly what it is. And I wonder, seeing some of the other books that are reviewed in this podcast, quite how that fits in. But one of the many motivations for writing the book, perhaps not the main one, but certainly I work in the area of market studies and social studies of finance, economic sociology more broadly. There's lots and lots of interesting work being done by excellent scholars, and it hasn't had that kind of visibility that you get, you know, if you walk into the bookshop, the bookshelves are absolutely laden down by books, economics can explain this and economics can explain that, and so forth. And because of some bits of luck along the way, I had an opportunity to put something from our position back into the market, and I took it. So this is how the book came about in those very simple terms.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention the other books in the podcast series, because I think this actually sits along things like the valuation studies in the life sciences book, which you actually contribute to. But also people like Will Davis's work,
Definitely.
And kind of questions of neoliberalism and stuff like this. I wonder then, actually, if you could kind of spell out the core argument in the book, particularly the two things that are going on around kind of both buying and selling things in monetary terms being really important to contemporary society, but also the kind of the science of economics that goes alongside that.
So there are two, if possibly three, sort of intertwined strands to the argument, and the first is to do with the role that economics has in our polity at the moment. You've got to remember, so I started working on this book in about 2011, and at that time we were really in the thick of austerity. Greece was collapsing. The evidence for austerity, as far as I could tell, was provided by two Harvard academics who it later turned out their spreadsheet had been knocked up by a student intern who'd got it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and this disconnect between the normative force, political force that economics broadly understood can claim, and the actual sort of sophistication and care and attention of the models that are underlying it, really, really very striking. So I think we can, you know, we can be uncomfortable at the way that economic reasoning has been adopted as a kind of policy measure. And that is underlain by ideas about economics as a science, economics as objective, and so forth, which I think come directly from Milton Friedman and Milton Friedman's reading of Popper, if you like. And I'm aware that this is a kind of caricature of what goes on in university economics departments. Yes, for sure. You know, we have lots of interesting people, but I don't think it's a caricature of what goes on among PPE graduates who are, you know, running the country, or people like the civil servants that you yourself have researched in the Treasury. The empirical research that I've seen shows people absolutely bound up in and compelled by a really quite rudimentary understandings of economic behavior and economic reasoning. And that seems to me to have tremendously, you know, damaging political consequences. So that's sort of one strand, if you like. And the other is, as a as I'm sure you know, I began my academic career long ago as a theologian, as an undergraduate and a master's student. And although lots of that has washed away, some bits have stuck. And among that is a profound sense of how interpersonal relationship should be and what it is to live a flourishing life, which is, you know, to do with sort of gift and service and stewardship and all these kind of traditional Anglican ideals, I suppose you might call them. And it seems to me that economic rationality is absolutely profoundly alienating. You know, it stands exactly against the development of that kind of good life and those kind of interpersonal relationships. So where you see economic rationality being inculcated in our interpersonal relationships, and to get there you have to go through the ideas about market devices and actor networks and agencement and all the kind of things that we take for read quite often in sociological studies of markets, then you see a problem that's you know, personal and philosophical as well as political. So those are the twin and perhaps irreconcilable aims with which I set out. And you'll have to tell me how well I did.
It's quite interesting, actually, because that dual aim, I think, is exemplified really well in the first chapter, or the first kind of substantive chapter, where you draw a kind of an arc of a sort of a history of economics from its kind of beginnings, you know, the things that most people are familiar with things like Smith, Theory of Moral Sentiments, these kinds of texts, Wealth of Nations. But you bring us to a point where we understand how what we might think of as kind of popular economics literature, the Freakonomics people, Tim Hartford, you know, these kinds of more popular popularizers of economic thinking, give us a what you call a kind of a almost a theory of the meaning of life itself through economics. And I wonder if you could say a bit about that development, because I think it answers those two aims quite well.
Yeah, certainly. Well, as you say, the you can go back to Smith and the Enlightenment, and there is some dispute in academic circles among whether Smith's view is a providential one or not, but as a bit of a dilettante, it seems to me that it is. That's the way the balance the balance of evidence seems to lie, that, you know, Smith has taken previous arguments about the organization of the world and simply transferred them into a secularized framework. And from there, I don't think that economics ever loses that sort of sense of the of somehow representing an arrangement of the world that is elsewhere inspired. So Foucault, for example, in The Birth of Biopolitics, talks about competition as a sublime object and the neoliberals as endlessly trying to progress towards that. And you have these same kind of theological overtones. So you can trace a little grand narrative, if you like, from those early beginnings through people like the marginalist revolutionaries who updated economics with heat physics, which is then the science of the day, through to Lionel Robbins explaining that economics is an engine of discovery, for telling us, you know, I forget the exact quote, but whatever, our, you know, examining our preferences as we choose between scarce means. Dennis Robertson saying, what does the economist economize? Of course he economizes on love. These are extraordinary claims for a discipline to be making, and they are philosophically overflowing. You know, Robertson's claim that if we don't ration out civic virtue, it will somehow run out, and we'll all be worse people, is an extraordinarily kind of complex claim crammed into a few little assumptions. And then who's next? Gary Becker, of course, expanding this theory of the rational analysis of preferences to every single walk of life, you know, whether how we decide to get married or whether or not we're prejudiced or how we hire people or whatever it may be, can all be analysed in this way. And then it seems to, you know, just be tweaked and dumbed down a little bit more, and you get Freakonomics, who will then tell you that, you know, economics can solve everything. Tim Harford, the economist, explains how economics is the is the discipline capable of answering, you know, any questions we would like, until the point where it really does provide a theory of life. It gives an account of every decision we might ever want to take. That wouldn't be so much of a problem if that's all it did, but it also wraps into these theories a normative account. So not only does it seek to explain how we take every decision that we ever take, but it also gives us an account of how we should do that. And it does so in a series of neat little footsteps that are almost unnoticeable until you end at a place that seems to me to be uncomfortable and problematic.
Yeah, and one of the consequences of this is the idea that it's not just a description of the world, but it has profound, what we might think of as kind of performative consequences.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One of the things you talk through is Tim Mitchell's work, which I found quite interesting, and also J.L. Austin together. And I wonder if you'd tell me a little bit about the idea that economics kind of makes the world, it makes facts, it does things in the world.
Well, we have the marvelous study of the making facts in the favela by Tim Mitchell, don't we? Of the what's the backstory to this is the neoliberal insistence on the primacy of property rights and the idea that if you give people property rights over their houses in the soil, houses is too grand a term, their dwellings, shacks in the slums in developing world countries, they will suddenly be able to you know, appeal to the rule of law and go off and get jobs and all the rest of it. And the story he tells is of this being empirically demonstrated by a PhD student called Erica Field, who then went on to be economics faculty at Harvard, was very, very successful on the basis of this work. And so it comes to be, you know, from the hypothesis that if you grant property rights, then these favelas suddenly become law-abiding districts where children no longer have to go to work because adults don't have to stay at school to stay at home to guard their houses, and the children can go to school. It all, by a sort of back to front process of logic, it all seems to become true. And Mitchell's analysis is slightly different. It is that the property rights were gifted by the bureaucrats very sensibly in the areas they felt were safest in a city that was becoming gentrified. So what they have identified is a correlation, of course, but not a cause. And this goes right back to Milton Friedman's idea of positive economics and the usefulness of inaccurate assumptions so long as they lead to falsifiable predictions. But, you know, I work in a school of management, and we've seen over the last, I don't know, 50 years or so, the growth of a science of management where all of these initial ideas about, you know, how we might hypothesize that businessmen act in order to understand or model what it is that they do have slowly been imbricated into business school theory and understandings of cost-benefit analysis as the appropriate way to do take investment decisions and so forth, and have been, exactly as you say, performed, brought real, made happen in the world, and you end up with a science of business administration that is a completely self-contained sort of, you know, logically consistent science built upon seemingly, well, I don't know, nothing at all, perhaps.
And it's interesting that kind of, I guess, forward march of business administration or business science depends on having a very particular view about how people operate, about the kind of the idea of economic man. And in the fourth chapter, you draw from a really wide range of examples from kind of Norwegian fishing, 18th century prison planning, contemporary university student behavior to tell a story about the creation of economic man. And I wonder if you could kind of talk me through that story.
I think some of this will chime very nicely with Will Davis's work on competition as well. But there's a considerable amount of literature of isolated empirical instance where decisions have been made by administrators, say, on the basis that people will act in a particular rational way. And then once these decisions have been played out in policy, you know, they've been made into frameworks of incentive or reward or metrics, whatever it may be, then it does really change the way that people act, people behave. So, for example, you know, the whole discourse of making universities charge fees to students, of making the students consumers, making universities compete, whatever we're competing for in a market beholden to students' satisfaction and so forth, has a complicated apparatus behind it of the REF, which you may have heard of, Dave, once or twice in
just a little
in your academic life, and you know that and the associated metrics and measurements that we have there. I don't know what the case is in sociology, but certainly in business schools, there is a list of journals, the dreaded ABS ranking. And the extraordinary thing about this is that we all acknowledge that the ABS ranking is, you know, a fiction of some kind. The REF panel were very clear that they didn't use it. They read the submissions. And yet it's such a useful institutional shorthand that it's still employed all the time. And little decisions on the list of what goes up and what goes down can make and break careers, I think. So you see the whole endeavor of what it is to be a student, what it is to be an academic, you know, to be a student, it is now to carefully manage the potential return on your investment, which we encounter very much in students wanting to take low risk course, students being very worried about how they can get a distinction and so forth. Academics wanting to play safe, wanting to engage in the kind of technically sort of technical wizardry, but perhaps, you know, intellectually low risk scholarship that they think can be got safely into those journals that are regarded as high ranking. And it's not to say that it's, you know, it's not good research, but perhaps at times it's not exciting research. And it's a very different idea of scholarship and studentship from what you might have found in a university. Even, I think, 25 years ago when I was an undergraduate, I think the rules were very, very different.
This vision of kind of, you know, sort of rational utility maximizing actor, whether in the university or in a variety of other settings, has got a range of devices, a range of kind of tools associated with him. And in chapter five, you talk through the idea of the credit score, about how, you know, the kind of economic man, as he's made through particular ideological positions, also has this moment of kind of technical devices that assist with this, you know, the kind of the example of moving from personal relationships between individuals and their bank managers or whatever to statistical forms of risk management.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely crucial. I think that's the most important step in the whole argument, is that these, you know, within these ideological wrappers, we depend upon constellations of devices to help us navigate the world every day. I mean, if one is supposed to be a consumer, just back to universities for a moment, if one's supposed to be a consumer and a potential student, then there's no way that you can decide which university will offer you best return on your investment and value for money without this infrastructure of lists and metrics and so forth. So it goes right the way down. And in the case of housing, yeah, the credit score is a very, very nice example. The story, it comes from Marth Poon's work on the birth of the FICO lending score, which we don't know much about in Britain, but I think in the United States one more or less lives or dies by it in terms of your credit applications and trying to get a flat and so forth. 20, 30 years ago, let's say, you know, in our parents' day, my father always used to say, oh, the bank manager knows what you're good for, you know, and there's a kind of sense that the bank manager's peacock in the local community, goes to the cocktail parties and, you know, is a person of some dignity. It's always a him, the bank manager. And he decides what to lend and what not to lend. And I don't want to be seen to be nostalgically, naively, always harking back to how things used to be as better or somehow pristine in a kind of Polanyist fashion. I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, you know, you can see obviously how difficult and toxic this relationship must at times have been. But nonetheless, this is how bank managers made decisions. They got to know people. They made use of a variety of cues such as, you know, kind of flashy dress or extravagant spouses or a disposition to the bottle or whatever it may be to decide whether to lend or not. And they were ultimately extremely conservative. One of the reasons for that conservatism is that it's a binary choice risk. It's either a good risk or a bad risk. Now, Poon tells us the story of how two enterprising operations researchers after the war began to discover and develop statistical means of graduating risk. And there's a long story about, you know, how they began in department stores in the Midwest, helping people, helping stores get slightly better returns on their higher purchase of furniture. And then they become involved in credit card issuance. And, you know, as they get more powerful, they subpoena the existing credit bureaus into sharing information and so forth until you get to the point where we are now, that every economically active citizen in the United States has the FICO score. And this FICO score is an indicator of how creditworthy you are. And it becomes possible for lenders to issue credit in a much more granular fashion on a nuanced kind of economically driven risk and return. So again, three decades ago, the traditional banking economics was that you didn't offer high risk, high return loans because the potential loss of the principal was too damaging. But now you can play with your algorithms until you decide that, well, these people are good loans and they can be issued with cheap loans, and these people are less credit worthy, so we make them pay more. It completely turns that relationship on its head. And of course, where it really matters is at some point in the 1990s, forgive me, I don't recall right now. The US Mortgage Bureau, Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae, decreed that 660, I believe, a FICO score of 660 was the point at which prime began. And everything below that was, of course,
subprime,
indeed. And therefore, the subprime is no longer a category where it is not safe to lend your money. It is a category where one can lend your money at risk for much more higher rates of return, higher rates of interest. And you step back out of this and you go, this is crazy. You know, what does someone who's a really bad credit risk, hasn't got a job, hasn't got an income, whatever it may be, hasn't got any security, what do they not need? It's a loan they can't afford at a very high interest rate. So at some point we see that, you know, common sense takes flight and we come tangled up in these models that are based on economic conceptions of risk and return and payoff. And look what happened.
But they also have sort of deeper consequences in how we think of individuals and perhaps how we think of humanity itself, both in terms of particular kinds of equivalences, for example, the equivalence between, say, a kidney and an education, but also through techniques such as the value of a statistical life and how we might think of healthcare costs and what is, I guess, a kind of a value for money intervention into human life. So chapters 6 and 7 cover those two topics. I wonder if you could deal with them together, the idea of this value of life, but also the idea of equivalence.
Yes, of course. well, they are all about equivalences, aren't they? And the various ways in which you made. So just as a bit of background, this idea of a value of statistical life represents the inferred value to which we attach risk, or which we attach to risk. So from people's willingness to attach to take risky work, from their willingness to pay for consumer safety, we could determine how much each individual would value an additional year of life, or some such. We get again a very nuanced statistical calculation of what life is effectively worth. The one hiccup in this, of course, is that in America it's worth several times as much as it is in the UK. The other hiccup, of course, is that those people who are most likely to be taking dangerous jobs, I would say, are those people who can least afford to not take them. So that represents a kind of double jeopardy, in that they if individuals are forced by the market is a little bit strong. They end up, through circumstances which are, you know, often complicated and unfortunate, working in places like construction sites and facing, you know, danger or on fishing boats, whatever it may be, facing danger on a daily basis. They don't earn an especially large amount of money because of the circumstances that have got them there in the first place. So if we then begin to infer the value that they place on their lives for policy prescriptions about how much we should spend on, you know, road safety or whatever it may be, or how much payoff should be set at, or machinery innovations, all those kind of things, then it seems to me there's a double jeopardy being played out on these unfortunate people. And there are all kinds of measures like this. There is the notorious quality adjusted life year, which is used in economic valuations of care. And again, that presupposes equivalences between a life here and a life there, and a treatment here and a treatment there, or equivalences that are made on the basis of this fundamental neoliberal idea about ourselves as somehow productive machinery, where we can invest in one part of, you know, invest in our intellectual capital by drawing on our physical capital and so forth, that make it possible for conversations to be had about, for example, a kidney sale, if it were legal, being swapped for a university education. And I think it's one of these difficult arguments where you can see at any point in this, any sort of micro level step in the argument, you can say, okay, I see the sense in that, I see the reasons behind this, but then collectively you arrive at a situation where it's considered completely legitimate for someone who wants an iPad. Well, perhaps this is an absurd example because there was media outrage, I recall, but it could easily be considered an equivalence for a person to sell a part of their anatomy or sexual services or whatever to go to college. And while there may be good micro-level grounds for justifying that, I think we have to step back and go, you know, is that the kind of society that we really want, or is education a public good that we should be providing in different sorts of ways? So this is again one of the things that troubles me, is the cumulative effect of these many valuations and equivalences that are made, often with good reason.
And how can we sort of carry this over into a critique of the most personal form of relationship, which is to do with how we choose partners, or, you know, how we date, how we kind of end up in particular romantic situations.
I presume you're referring to the work that we've done on online dating with my colleague Shona Chillis here in St Andrews. I think online dating is a perfect example of one of these situations where people become embedded in socio-material technological networks that configure the outcomes and the choices in a very particular way. So, you know, when you go on the dating site, you don't do all the choosing by yourself. You choose quite often. A lot of it is done for you by the algorithm. Even if it isn't, you know, your choices are guided and directed, constructed in particular ways. And the rhetoric that surrounds these sites is often, you know, if you listen to Classic FM while you're doing the washing up, as I'm sure you do, you'll hear the it's a slightly
we have very different tastes in music.
It's a slightly older demographic than the new Dr. O'Brien, the Classic FM, and they advertise a dating site with, along the lines of, get someone who's right for you just now to share what you know, share the things you like doing and enjoy what you like doing. And the emphasis is it's really like a, you know, going to buy a new jacket and you get it and it'll fit perfectly. And if you don't like it, you know, take it back. Now, again, I'm being very careful here not to be nostalgic for the old days of the village or anything like that, but we do know from those who research relationships in psychology that good relationships, flourishing relationships, are built on long-term commitment, mutuality, and sharing, which is all about not knowing. It's about discovery. It's about some taking a risk. These, you know, these are the kind of things that make relationships successful, and they don't seem to me to be implicated in what's on offer on an online dating site. But I do understand why a 25-year-old, or maybe a 35-year-old working in Manhattan, working in 60 hours a week in a tower block, is going to go online, because everybody else is. So again, we have this problem of scale, that it seems that our collective choices as a society are somehow undermined by the choices that face individuals and that are often taken up entirely reasonably on a day-to-day basis.
Now, the book ends, I think, really wonderfully by not sort of, you know, concluding that, oh, everything's terrible and, you know, isn't this awful and stuff like this, but setting out a you know, sort of a manifesto for what we might do about this, how we might think the world differently, both in terms of those, you know, individual questions, but also on, you know, the more macro level. So I wonder if you could sort of conclude by sharing with us what the manifesto is, what, you know, what the way of challenging economics might be.
Well, I think you put it very nicely. It's just some suggestions about how we may think the world differently, and really it splits into those same two kind of lines of arguments. So on the one hand, you know, let's think differently about management. Let's not try and you know, go for the easy answer that's cost benefit analysis. Let's reclaim our polity and so forth. And I have to say, I mean, we saw the excitement around the Scottish referendum and the lead up to that last year, and now the excitement about Jeremy Corbyn. And I think, you know, the charming thing about Corbyn, whatever else one may think about him, is his insistence that things do not have to be as they are. And that is such a seems such a radical and revolutionary claim. Of course, to those of us who think in sociological terms, there's nothing inevitable about where we are. You know, we are here because of a complex, you know, historically, intellectually contingent pattern that's got us there. And if we don't like it, we have to do something about it. So there are some comments about reviving the polity and changing the way we make collective decisions and so forth, which I think I'm delighted to see are working out in politics anyway. And the other strand of it, of course, is trying to overcome these profoundly alienating positions of economic rationality at a personal level, and pursue some kind of personal re-enchantment. So I think the very last part of the manifesto is simply something like, let's rediscover amazement, let's rediscover awe, you know, that sort of childlike simplicity when confronted by, whether it's, you know, a stunning goal from Liverpool Liverpool FC or whether it's a cathedral or a mountain side or whatever it may be, to recover some of that sort of surprise and amazement and sense that there are things that simply cannot be measured, cannot be quantified, and have value exactly because of that.
In terms of what you've been doing after the book, has it been, you know, kind of carrying the manifesto forward with, you know, other academic work, or has it been, you know, a case of kind of switching to something completely new? What has been the kind of, you know, the development of the agenda following the book?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask that. I mean, to some extent, it's just been doing bits and bobs because that's the way that things have worked out. I'm laying the groundwork for an empirical project on the smaller company stock markets in London in the 90s and the early noughties, which is historical sociology of a less well-known episode of financialization. So that could be interesting. That could be nice. In terms of the arguments in the book generally, I mean, these have progressed. So when I wrote the first edition, the manifesto wasn't in it, and I was invited to put the manifesto in the paperback, and that was nice for me because I'd spent a bit of time talking about the book post publication, and done a few interviews and what have you, and had a chance to think through some of these ideas in more detail, so they appear in the manifesto. And then there's a subsequent conversation, internal conversation, as we all have, saying, well, look, you know, if the things we do as management scholars really are performative, if they really do shape the world in that way, then what should we do about it? You know, what can we say to managers as a critically inclined performativity scholar? And I'm working on some early thoughts in that direction, how we might reapproach some aspects of management ethics, possibly again underlined by a postmodern theological perspective, perhaps. But so you'll have to wait and see on that one.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Philip Roscoe about A Richer Life, how economics can change the way we think of theory.